This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to Jikoji. Thanks for being up here on a nice day. We got a lot of people in this room. We're nowhere near the 10,000 Buddhas in Vimalakirti's small residence that one of the sutras talks about, but we're close. Today, I want to talk about one of the stanzas we chant in the Heart Sutra and also in our robe chant. In our robe chant, we say, field far beyond form and emptiness. And in the Heart Sutra, we say, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's a pretty dry topic, so please take a nap if you'd like. In Sanskrit, form is, the word is rupa. And in the Sanskrit of the Heart Sutra, it says, rupam sunyata, sunyata va rupam. And sunyata is emptiness, or formlessness, or a boundlessness, or impermanence. And rupa is a term that's defined as matter and is derived from the term rupati, which it means to be deformed, to be disturbed, to be knocked about and broken. And matter is so called because it undergoes and also imposes alteration owing to physical conditions that arise. And the Buddha reportedly explained, he said, "Why, monks, do you say material form or rupa? Why do we say material form? Because it is deformed, rupati. Therefore, it is called material form. Deformed by what? Deformed by cold, by heat, by hunger, by thirst, by flies, by mosquitoes, by wind, by sun, and creeping things." Now, when the Buddha talks about rupa in that context, it almost sounds like it's body flesh, body form. I'm also a civil engineer, and so there are a lot of other forms, like rebar and concrete and wood and of different kinds and strengths. And I just, in the Heart Sutra, to talk about form is emptiness, emptiness is form, I want to kind of explore this a little bit more. So we sit here quietly. It seems like we're pretty still. But I want to put this place we're in context. The universe is expanding at a rate of 40 miles a second. The Milky Way galaxy is moving at about that rate, 40 miles a second. But there's other trouble in the local galactic sphere. Andromeda galaxy is moving towards us at a rate of 70 miles a second. It'll take a few 10,000 years to get here, or millions of years, if that in fact is what keeps happening. The sun revolves around the center of the Milky Way, and you know the Milky Way is a fairly I guess we can't see it from outside where we are, but it's a spiral galaxy. And it hasn't rotated that many times, because otherwise, like when we do our chocolate milk, it gets pretty stirred up pretty quickly. The Milky Way is pretty intact in all the different arms that it has, because they say dark matter is part of a large part of what our universe holds. And so instead of the center rotating fast, much, much faster than the outside, it all kind of is revolving. My understanding is that it revolves fairly uniformly, but our sun, our solar system, revolves around the center of the galaxy at about 140 miles a second, which is close to 0.1% the speed of light, which is pretty fast. So when people say stop the world, they want to get off, and you're going 0.1% the speed of light, slow it down. How do we slow it down? Good luck. But we're on it. And so, you know, with the Milky Way moving through space and the sun moving through the Milky Way, the trace of the sun through space is like a helix over time. Now, the Earth, of course, rotates at about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator and 0 miles an hour at the poles, but it rotates around the sun at a rate of about 18 to 20 miles a second. And so, and the moon in that year time goes around 13 times around the Earth, so you have all of these spiraling helixes leaving traces, if there is such a thing as a trace, through space. Now, coming to the microscopic level, our blood, let's say we our blood cells, look at one blood cell and how it moves from our heart through the different tubes in our body, our arteries and veins, the capillaries through the tissue. And if you were to trace how a blood cell moves through the body, it too would, of course, it's starting and stopping with a heart pulse, but it also leaves, if you were to track all the blood cells in our body, it would look like braids.
Like what?
Braids, hair, like braided hair, like it's all intertwined. Now, I'm working my way towards consciousness here. I guess we have a lot of blood flow to our brains because our brains actually use 20% of our calories. Maybe if you're a deep thinker, you use more. But about 20% of the calories we burn is from this 1.4 kilograms, about 3 pounds of mass, which is anywhere from 1/50th to 1/100th of our body mass. So it is actually, our brain is... the caloric rate at which it burns is like 6 times what other tissue burns at. So when you track all the firings that are going on within a brain to the different regions of the brain, there's even on a molecular level with the, I'm sure there are a lot more elements than these, the sodium, the calcium, the phosphorus and potassium, you know, all of those atoms are moving in within a cell and between cells. And you trace all of that movement, we are a dynamic system. You know, from these vessels that we each have, and there's no stopping it. Since we were born, this brain does not stop. It is on constant fire. Of course, we go through the cycles of sleep and awakeness, but it's definitely we have all of this information that we are accosted with. Sometimes it may feel that way, or that we enjoy, that makes for quite an elaborate network of activity. And what is, you know, where, how can consciousness come about from matter is one of the questions that many, many people have pondered. But we have this dynamic organic system that combines all this information that we get from our senses in the different parts of our brain. You know, they can localize where our smell resides in the brain, where our sight is, where the sounds come, and they can also turn off these different types of consciousness when they might cut some neurons, then a person or an organism will lose its sight or its hearing sensations. And there's other ways they end up getting compensated. For example, if you lose your hearing, when the sound of a bell happens, there are percussion waves that hit your skin. And so you can feel a door slam, even though you may not hear it, you can feel it. And so there are other ways to understand that. So the Abhidhamma is a text that was compiled a few hundred years after the Buddha. And it's a wonderful compendium of how we function in wholesome and unwholesome ways. It's a Buddhist-like psychology text, and so it doesn't have, it covers a lot of the territory that, you know, modern psychology does, but in a whole different set of terms and contexts. But according to the Abhidhamma, Rupa, matter, is twofold, two main parts. One is the four great essentials, which they defined as earth, air, fire, and water. And then the second set, which includes 10 more things, includes sense phenomena, objective phenomena, and the sense phenomena would be our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body. The objective phenomena would be what we observe, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste. Earth is experienced as hard or soft. Air is experienced with the varying pressures that we can feel. Fire is experienced as heat and cold. Taste is experienced as sweet and bitter, and so on. The third element of material phenomena described in the Abhidhamma is the sexual phenomena of male and female. The fourth one is heart base, recognizing the heart and the importance of the heart in serving the body and providing blood to maintain the four essentials for our being. The fifth element of material phenomena is life, the vitality faculty The sixth element of material phenomena are the nutriments, the edible sustenance we get. And then the last three elements, four elements, are non-concretely produced matter. Space, which delimits or delineates objects, so we have space between us so we can tell each other apart. There's communication that happens between with the body and with the voice. And then there's the mutable phenomena, things being light, the lightness of things that dispels the heaviness in matter, the malleability of phenomena that dispels rigidity in matter, and is in non-opposition to any kind of action, and the wieldiness, the ability to work with phenomena, and that takes bodily action and results in harmony with what you're working with when we know how to work with the different things that are in our realm. And then the last element of material, of matter, of the material phenomena is the stages of the phenomena, from production, which would be the genesis and the rising, the continuity of the production, which is what we experience now with the continuing of our life, the repeated genesis and arising of new matter, like our hair, our skin, our nails. And then there's the decay, which we're all embarking on. And finally, impermanence, death. When I got to this point, I realized I hadn't talked about any of the more important aspects of Buddhist practice, which have to do with the paramitas and the precepts. I wanted to just talk about the materiality of our existence today, and recognize that how important it is, because we usually don't consider it. We basically can appreciate, you know, the trees, the different animals that are around, the shapes of the rocks and the colors of the stones. Speaking of which, I got one in my pocket here. I got a piece of quartz, which is about 60 grams. And 60 grams is about one mole, 10 to the 23rd, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd molecules are in this rock. Now, at the beginning, we chatted about having it to see and listen to, you know, the 100,000 million kalpas. So I want to, that's a term that's used to talk about infinity in a way, but I want to put it in context of this rock, that within this 10 to the 23rd atoms of silicon dioxide in this rock, that if you were to consume one molecule an hour every day for one kalpa, which would be the length of time our universe has been in existence of 13 billion years, you would still have another almost 100,000 million kalpas of material left. And so a kalpa is like 13 billion years, and so 100,000 million of those, if you took one molecule per hour per day for 100,000 million kalpas, it would finally be gone. So the vastness of time is encapsulated in a small object. And so here we are with this organ that's consuming six times the calories of the rest of our body, that is aware of different things going on simultaneously, and somehow the workings of our brain connecting these different parts together, trillions of different bits of information, becomes our consciousness. And there's a neurologist, psychiatrist named Giulio Tononi, who wrote this book called Phi. And he talks about Phi is integrated information, the integrated information of our mind comes together in one whole, a shape that is, he says, consciousness is everything we have, everything we are. Each experience is a unique shape made of integrated information, a shape that is maximally irreducible. And you can call it the shape of understanding. And it's the only shape that's really real, the most real thing that is. This shape of understanding that each of us has. It may be, there are all different kinds of understandings we can have, from confused to delusional to quite clear, insightful understandings. But it's just amazing that the flickering of neurons allows for us to have this experience of being here, being awake, being alive on this Earth that's rotating around the sun, on this solar system in the Milky Way, in this galaxy. And we're a part of a hugely dynamic process that wears us out from time to time, so we got to go take a nap or go to sleep. But it sure is exciting to study, to participate in, and to recollect on. So not only does this integrated information is happening, but then besides that, we have this experience, these neurons are also able to assess and investigate, you know, what we just experienced. And so there's this assessment part of our consciousness that's here. So it's pretty amazing what we each get to have in this life that we each have right now. It comes to an end. It has a beginning. I should start the other way. It has a beginning. It comes to an end. Recently, I've had some intimate experiences with both of new grandsons, and of a mother that at 95 passed away, and to investigate the workings at the beginning and at the end is just, it's really amazing. Even at the point of dying, a person can have a strong life force of saying, it's time to move on. There's other things to do. And so, in a way, that is not a life-negating aspiration or intention. It is vital. And I was able to experience that with my mother, that kind of vitality, even in dying. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going on to a better place. It's like, I'm done. This body is done. It's time to go. And it wasn't anything like, oh, Mom, please stay around. It was like, no, she wanted to go. That's what she needed to do. And she did it. But then, poof, this body is gone. It dissolves. And what happens with that consciousness that fires in this organ that we each have, burning so many calories and giving us so much trouble? So we come and we practice. We come and explore. And that's what this practice, this Buddhist practice that we engage in, to me is about. It is about exploring our lives, exploring our what's going on, and hopefully making some progress in how we do things. For example, I've noticed that my genetic makeup is such that I can notice tendencies that others in my family have of gestures that they make, of ways that they talk, of body motions, of other habitual things, including ways of thinking. And some of them we think, oh, this is how it is, but some of them are actually can be worked with and in ways that allow us to not be trapped by them. Our graspings, which when we look at our preferences, I prefer a clear glass of water instead of a dirty glass of water, or a dirty glass of water, absolutely not. You know, you push it away. So your attractions, your repulsions to things, and neutral aspects to it. And so I guess that's where we take this form that we have and experience with and get to decide whether our preferences are going to rule our lives. Oftentimes our preferences are culturally based or family-based, genetically-based, probably lots of other, based on other things, who we're with, what social context we're in, and to be able to come and sit quietly and examine a preference being around people that you don't like. And I would imagine that school teachers have to deal with that a lot. You know, you have a lot of different kids in your class, some you really like and some you don't, but you have them all and you have to accept them all. And so how does one do that? I've never had to be in that situation of being a teacher where of young kids like that, of maybe a couple kids, a few kids. But then there's, you know, appropriate behavior and inappropriate behavior, wholesome behavior, unwholesome behavior. And so investigating those things are important things for us to do. And coming to your cushion, whether it's here or at home or somewhere else, to investigate this allows you freedom with the preferences, freedom from the preferences, so that the irritation maybe of another being, you can look at it and say, I feel irritated by the actions of this person. But you can recognize that that irritation is not that person. That irritation actually, it emanates here, that irritation is mine, that my irritation. And so to notice that it's my irritation then it becomes mine, and I can look at it. I can look at my irritation, but suddenly the child who I'm irritated with is free of the irritation, because it is that irritation belongs to me. It doesn't belong to him. He's not irritated. He's happy. He's doing what he wants to do. He's totally has no clue about my irritations. Even if I scream at him, then he's irritated with me. But then I've imposed a whole set of other karmic stuff on him. But this little trick, I call it a trick. It's actually a Tibetan Buddhist notion of where you take what is your own projections and you see them as that, and then that liberates it does not eliminate your irritation, but when you recognize that it's mine, when I realize that it is my anger, that other person isn't angry, it's my irritation, that other person isn't irritated, then I can turn back and say, oh, look, you tied your shoes so nicely today. Way to go, Bill. And maybe that one statement of positive encouragement to that child who is irritating, actually, suddenly he stands a bit taller and it changes his trajectory. So coming to work with these aspects of our consciousness is really important for us to be able to grow into the different stages that we occupy in this life, from being a young baby and screaming because our diaper is dirty, or because we're hungry or we're tired, and then the communication begins, to later stages in life where suddenly the me part has to dissolve when you become a parent. If you're a me person and you're a parent, then the child is neglected. And so you develop these other aspects that help us appropriately engage in our reality. One last thing that I think relates to this too is some things that have been said recently. Like, one is that truth isn't truth. There was a political figure that made that statement, that truth isn't truth. And then maybe nothing's real can be taken from that. But in many different fields of endeavor, like in the scientific realm, truth is something that is based on experimentation. In the sphere of law, the facts exist. Let's see. Scientific truth is a statement of probability proportional to the evidence, and it can change as the evidence changes. So it's based on evidence. Then there's journalistic truth, which professional journalists test the accuracy of the information with more than one source, and they collect as much relevant evidence as possible before deadline. And so there's the task of assessing the truth of the matter is something that is taken quite seriously. In a legal sense, there's basically two kinds of truth that are talked about. One is actual truth, which is also called substantive truth. But there's also truth in the legal sense that is agreed upon in a legal forum, that even if a fact has not occurred, it is established as a legal fact because of the context of the situation recognizes that that particular fact has a context in which it operates, and it comprises one of many values that compete for the ultimate realization of the judgment in a legal forum. So, in Buddhism, we talk about truth as the Dharma, capital D Dharma, the truth of our existence, the truth of the laws of how life functions and how the different Buddha fields operate. And that's where the Eightfold Path and the six paramitas and the 10 prohibitory precepts all come from. So I guess today I wanted to just talk about rupa, matter of this existence, that we attend to it as best we can, that we give it its due, that though it is said that we should be children, as if children in an illusion, in how we play with the different facets in our lives, that this reality also is not an illusion. It is when you can look in the distance and see a mountain and then drive to it and climb it and get to the top of it. When you've seen it in the distance, is it an illusion? I think maybe it's an illusion in the sense that you're only seeing a tiny context of it, and that the entire context of the mountain is way bigger than what we could ever experience. So, are there any questions? Yes? Yes.
Yes, sir. I was reflecting over form is emptiness and emptiness is form, and it occurs to me that if truly everything is meaningless,
Meaningless?
If everything is empty, then maybe there's something I don't understand, but it would seem also meaningless to me if it were empty. But maybe I'm not understanding emptiness. And so I wonder if that's the case, then how did we get into this situation where we associate meanings with everything, clinging to things, and we are afraid of that meaninglessness? Because, you know, I'm afraid of meaninglessness. I'm afraid of being nothing. So, you know, is there more to it than that? Is there something beyond that emptiness? Is a question that arises.
Yes, so his question had to deal with emptiness and nothingness and the meaninglessness of emptiness. So the Buddhist term emptiness does not mean the absence of anything. That is not the Buddhist meaning of it. That's a nihilistic definition of being empty. What emptiness talks about, sunyata, is that there is no, that this rock is in a state of transformation. And since it has so many different contexts in which it exists and operates, and where it is in my hand right now, that it's going to move from my hand. And so it is this, and it will dissolve over time. I put this in a river, and 32 million years later, it will be much smaller from tumbling down. And so this rock, as a fixed entity that does not change through time, it does not exist. All things change through time, including like a uranium isotope that no longer becomes a, once it disintegrates and decays, it becomes lead and some other element. And so where is the fixity of that uranium? It is no longer, it is not fixed, it is not permanent. It is empty of its own existence. And likewise, this body I have, it's called Doug right now, but in 100 years, it will be in the atmosphere, it'll be in the ground, it'll be in the water. You know, every month we, it's said that about, we're about 3 cubic feet of mass and 2/3 of our mass is water. And so our body is replaced, our body water is replaced every month. And then it goes into the ground, into the rivers, into the ocean, into the air, and it's back again. And water molecules, even if you have a pure glass of water, there are molecules of water here that have passed through countless beings, animals, Julius Caesar, Jesus Christ, Buddha, and so. We each, you cannot get water that has not passed through something else, because that's its nature. And so what is fixed about this? And that's why it's empty of it, of any nature of its own, any unchanging nature. And so knowing that things are impermanent, impermanence and emptiness coincide. So it's an impermanence. Does that help a little?
It does. I would like to let someone ask a question, although I have one, but I would like not to steal the time that others have with you as well.
But do you have anything else on this emptiness?
Yes, I do. A follow-up question would be, if that is the meaning of emptiness, then it means that life is not meaningless, but the meaning in life has to be attained from the change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The freedom in it arises from the change. And for example, in our practice, the form here at Jikoji is a lot less stringent than a lot of other places. And other places, the forms, the robes, the way you walk, the way you do a service, there's strict forms and how it's done, and you do it right or you do it wrong. Well, actually, when you do a form, when you do a ceremony provides a structure, a beginning, a middle, and an end for the ceremony that helps to bring meaning to the circumstance. And if you're only focused on the form of the ceremony of like, oh, well, he's lighting some incense now. And, instead of like understanding that a burning candle, for example, is dissolving as we're here. And the meaning of the change can be encapsulated in ceremony that really the... A ceremony that's done exquisitely is freeing of the to those that witness the ceremony. So people have probably gone to funerals where they do the form and of like offering the condolences to the family and going on to talk about the life, and it almost runs much like a valedictorian speech does at a commencement address. You can predict what's going to be there. But a ceremony that comes alive uses the elements of that ceremony to touch heart. And then the ceremony has meaning. And it may be that the ceremony, the actual ceremony itself, maybe the it was the wrong kind of incense, according to somebody, which is a preference to tripping while you bow, which can be also be interesting. All these different qualities are part of that ceremony, but the the point of it isn't just to, well, we did the middle, the beginning, the middle, and the end, but the point is that that ceremony provides structure to communicate deeper meaning of the changingness of our existence. And one of the other heart sutras we chant, another one, instead of using the term emptiness, it uses the term boundlessness. Form is boundlessness. Boundlessness is form. And so it's I want to be clear that the term has no nihilistic aspects to it. Other than nihilism is part of the whole package too, right? I mean, negating things is something that happens, so it's part of the whole thing. And it, that too changes. So when a person is nihilistic and denies existence of something or someone, or denies a problem or someone, eventually that problem shows itself. And it isn't gone. It's there. Repeating that news is fake over and over and over again is, in a way, it diverts everybody's attention, but actually things come back to bite the one who says that. After a while, I think.
Hopefully.
So thank you for bringing up about emptiness. Yes, Mark.
Thank you, Doug. Also, the name of the Heart Sutra is sometimes called Understanding Beyond Understanding.
Wisdom and beyond wisdom.
What's that?
Wisdom beyond wisdom, too.
Yeah, it's Wisdom Beyond Wisdom, but like Thich Nhat Hanh has renamed it Understanding Beyond Understanding. And to me, what that refers to is the mystical quality of our lives, meaning that although we have the ability through this brain to do our very best to understand what it is, there's a wisdom or an understanding beyond understanding. It's kind of a sense, a felt presence that is kind of hinted at. And using words, we kind of recognize the limitation of the words as just representing something that is ineffable, can't be really put into words. And that's one of the things I really like too about the Heart Sutra, is that it recognizes that not everything can be kind of tied up in a nice bow and, oh, now this makes sense. It's something that's felt.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to respond a little bit by what Giulio had said, that our experience is, each experience is a unique shape made of integrated information, a shape that is maximally irreducible, the shape of our understanding. So all these things come together in one moment, and you can't reduce it any further than that. You can try to, but it's not part of the whole experience anymore. So to get beyond understanding, beyond understanding, there are no words. There's, what kind of experience is that, an understanding beyond understanding? That's a question. Anybody have an answer?
Maybe that's the truth.
Yeah.
Maybe it's experience beyond experience.
Do we pass out the LSD this afternoon?
Yeah.
Can we experience lunch first?
It's time. Yeah. It is. Way past time. Well, thank you all. We're going to...
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to enter them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.